Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Alicia Dara. I am an executive speech and presentation coach, and I'm the founder of Woman Cake magazine.
Woman Cake Magazine. Wow, what a great title. Well, before we get on to that, I wonder if I could ask you my stereotypical question that I posed to just about everybody, which is if you would share with us what's currently retarding, dynamizing, preoccupying, interesting.
Sure. I want to preface this by saying that I think, like every other human being, I have a low level but ongoing degree of climate anxiety that just never switches off. I even had some more dreams about it last night. I don't feel like I ever get a break from that. But if we just take that as a given, I can start at the top of my list. Professionally, I am always thinking about the plight of my clients, who are predominantly professional women, in particular corporate women. They're employed in corporate America. And I am thinking all the time about their experiences and about their sense of self within these systems that are not designed by women for women to succeed. So many of my clients are, excuse me, they are essentially what they know, what they've come to know, and what they the life that they live inside those systems is about surviving and prevailing. But what they are missing and what they need more than anything is to reclaim the idea of thriving. Thriving professionally on a day-to-day basis, thriving on the projects they work on at work, and thriving across the arc of their career. And again, if you are someone who's been employed in these systems, if you're a woman who's been employed in these systems either periodically or completely within your career, you may not know what that looks or feels like. You may not have ever had that experience. And I think these systems are, if such a thing is possible, I think they are uniquely patriarchal or distinctly patriarchal in the sense that they really rely because they don't want women to be a threat to the men in power, right? And so, and you can see this, by the way, reflected in the data. There are so many companies that I work with and many that I know who make these big public statements about how much gender and, for that matter, racial equity they have achieved inside their system. But if you look at the data, anybody, you don't need to like a data science degree to see that all of that equity is happening below a certain level. So above a certain level, it's very, very white and male there. Okay. So you have these women who are in these systems, and the systems depend on them viewing themselves as siloed within a silo. So the idea is that the women take on this mindset where success is a zero-sum game, which is a really, really big part of patriarchal values, right? So success is a zero-sum game. And also every other woman is viewed as competition, direct competition. So in my profession, I have private clients, certainly, but my real joy is to do what we call gender-based caucusing. So I go into these companies and I do this either on site in person or remotely. And I gather together a group of women, and typically they're, mid to high level women in the company, and I teach them very high level speech and presentation skills. Sometimes this is known as executive presence, but I kind of have my own sort of, I don't know, problems with that terminology. But in any case, the great joy of my professional life is being with these women when they are together and seeing the extraordinary transformation that can happen just by being together in these spaces where they are learning new skills that are all about communication and expression and presentation, and feeling them and seeing them connect to a much deeper sense of self and a sense of power that comes not just from their own ocean of skills, knowledge, wisdom, and expertise, which is what I feel when I'm in the room with them, but also their ability to sense and feel and attune to each other, to each other's experiences. God, it's so funny. I gave a training back in January. I gave a training with a new company that I'd never worked with before, and I flew there to be with them on site. And I had been in communication with one woman in particular. She was my sort of contact with the company, and she arranged the whole thing. She was originally in HR, but she moved to a different department. Anyway, she and I had been in contact, and I felt that I, as I do often with my client, every time with my clients, I felt that I was very prepared for the experience. And I felt I had done some research about them. And I sort of, she and I had spoken extensively about what this group was like and what their history was, et cetera. But I didn't know until I got in the room that many of these women, there's a group of women who've been working at this company for almost 20 years, and they barely knew anything about each other. Like, inside this company, what they were used to doing was sharing, like they'd get into a meeting together and they would share weather, traffic, and basic pleasantries about, I don't know, maybe children of the weekend. That's it. They didn't know. They didn't even know what each other had been working on, the projects they'd been working on for the past 6 weeks. They didn't even know because they don't have the architecture. They don't have the mindset, like the mental architecture, and they don't have the architecture built inside these systems. So this is always, always on my mind. And I'm always doing every single week, I have 2 hours that I dedicate or more that I dedicate to reading about what's going on with women inside these systems. I have Substacks I follow. I have blogs I read. I have articles and writers that I follow and, you know, data scientists who are looking at things. And I'm trying to educate myself as much as possible so I can be present with them. So, and, you know, help and assist them as best I can. So that's thing number one. Mm-hmm. Thing number two, kind of overlaps. I realize I sort of have like sort of an ongoing run-on sentence, but I'm so happy to get to talk about this. And I do want to say, Toby, like I love your work and I become such a fan of your podcast tonight. And I'm so honored to be your guest. And I should have said that at the beginning. So thank you very much for having me and giving me this opportunity. Thing number two that I'm thinking about is really very much about being Generation X and being aware of the fact that my generation has arrived at the stage of life, which is known as perimenopause and menopause, without anywhere near the adequate amount of things that we need to thrive in this stage of our life. And I have broken it down to what I call the big three. It is state-of-the-art healthcare, political power, and cultural visibility. We do not have anywhere near of these things. But my theory is, my sense is that we won't get the first two. We won't really be able to get state-of-the-art healthcare and political power if we don't have the third one, cultural visibility. And right now, and I'd love to get your take on this, to my eyes, it looks like we can't see each other very well right now in the culture. I mean, I think this is true. I don't know. This is, I'm sure, part of a much larger problem that exists culturally and politically, where women reach a certain age and they're just thrown out of the spotlight, you know, for all the usual sexist ageist reasons, you know. But we need to see each other more. We need to understand each other's experiences. We need to tell our stories and hear each other. We need to make media that celebrates our stories. I believe that the mythology of an experience, the creative, cultural sort of, oh God, what's the word I'm looking for? Like hummus of the experience, where all these things kind of take, I don't mean in the like goes good with baby carrots way, but I mean in the like deep sort of earthy melange of these things need to come together in a way for no other reason than just for us to have a communal experience. But also, I think, again, to maybe also achieve some degree of power in the culture. I don't know. What's your take on all that?
Well, in terms of the United States, I think a very interesting issue because of the predominance of commercial culture and commercial media there, which is also very important elsewhere, but especially so there. On the one hand, there are these patriarchal structures of which you speak that are immensely powerful within things like advertising, journalism, and drama, Hollywood, etc. On the other, there is a desire to target people who are going to be viable, important consumers, which sometimes includes Gen X women. But mm-hmm. by and large, as you know, the problem is that advertising is interested in young people, with the alibi being their brand preferences haven't yet been set in stone.
Right, right.
So yeah. They are malleable when it comes to buying a yacht or toothpaste. Right? And
yes.
The most prized object of all in this is the dude, because the dude seems to have greater income now and in the future, and to make fewer purchases in number, but greater ones in value, right? This mm-hmm. sort of crap is the way mm-hmm. that these people think. So that can have kick-on effects, not just from the advertising milieu, but into all these other cultural sectors.
Yes, yes.
And it seems to me that Some of this is changing. Disney just announcing it's not going to make endless more Marvel movies.
Oh, right. I saw that. Yeah.
Right? We'll see how long that lasts.
Right.
But I think it's a very, very real issue. The other thing in the United States is you mentioned politics. It is staggering, yet not, that there's been one woman vice president,
Yeah.
no woman
Yeah.
president, so
Yeah.
few women on the Supreme Court, all these other domains. And
Yeah.
when you consider how close the Equal Rights Amendment has been to passing,
Oh, it drives me nuts every day.
I mean, it's almost a century now it's been on the books, and it's almost on the books. It's
Oh.
over 40 years since it nearly passed.
Yeah.
It has to be a dedicated attempt to get that passed and to put
Agreed.
real, vegetable on the vegetable, as it were. So
Agreed.
I think those things are utterly essential. It's a worldwide problem, and it can sometimes be related to religion, sometimes related to class, but always related to the sorts of patriarchal structures that you're discussing. So that's
Yes.
a long-winded answer to your
Yes.
point.
Beautiful. Yeah. Oh God, so much to say in response. I got to meet Sarah Weddington, who was the attorney who at age 27 successfully argued Roe v. Wade. I got to meet her years and years ago through my work as a volunteer with Planned Parenthood. And I asked her, Ms. Weddington, it must be very interesting. She was doing a tour, sort of a media tour related to something she had released. I believe it was a book or something like that. And I asked her, it must be very interesting for you to see all of the activism that has really risen up around the world around this issue in the wake of that decision and everything that has gone on since. And she looked me in the eye and she said, Alicia, I had no idea when I argued this case in my late 20s in front of the Supreme Court that we would still be talking about this. She goes, I thought it was decided. I thought we had determined. Yes, it is a right. And she was just, and you could see, oh God, you could see on her face that she was sort of reliving that reality. Like she was right back there in that moment, and just sort of like a sense of shock and a sense of, I mean, really a kind of a weary despair about the fact that it is an ongoing issue. It remains an ongoing issue. I think the mindset, gosh, I'm just thinking about my clients that I get to talk to every day, and of course, my close girlfriends that I've known for 20 years. And I mean, without a doubt, across the board, our mindset is darker. I don't know. You know what, Toby? I'll tell you this. And maybe you've had this experience too. I try on the days when I feel the darkest about this particular issue and about what it represents, because of course it is not just about the idea of reproductive justice. It represents so much more. And the ERA, speaks to that. On the days when I feel the darkest, I try to remember the counsel and the words of women like Sarah Weddington and other older women that I have known in my life who have reminded me that in terms of any kind of social justice struggle or any kind of human rights struggle, and certainly in terms of the pro-choice movement globally, there has always been the momentum has always really been two steps forward, one step back. And I think my generation may have grown up in a period up until just recently, this point, where we had a big sort of a, like just generationally, we had the experience of taking constant leaps forward. And so it might be that it feels particularly dark to us, not to discount or minimize the effects because it is dire, but it might be that it feels especially this way to us because we came of age during a period when there was such a powerful global momentum,
I
So I
appreciate
try to take,
it.
yeah, I mean, yeah.
I remember when Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976 to replace Gerald Ford. And
Yes.
I thought this meant the entire future of the United States would be democratic.
Right. Yeah.
When pollution became a
Yeah.
big issue in the late 60s, early 70s, people didn't talk about the environment there because these things were delimited more to our pond or that river. But I
Right.
remember
Yeah.
thinking, well, that's over. There's not going to be any problem about this. It's all going to be fixed.
Yeah.
And I certainly remember when Roe versus Wade was decided, believing exactly what you believe many years
Yeah.
later. And I
Yeah.
was teaching at a school in the southern United States when this terrible newish decision came down. And I remember a college. And I remember standing in line to get food, at the refectory. And the young women behind me talking very openly about which states they would go to in order
Oh,
to
yeah.
have a termination, should
Oh,
that be
yes.
necessary,
Yes.
in the most open and rational terms.
Yes.
And I wondered as I listened to this, because they must have known that this elderly fogey man would be listening, or if not
Yes.
listening, would catch their drift, right?
Yes.
I remember thinking, this is a very good sign at one level in amongst all this horror, which is that these young women who are so often, it is said, uninterested in feminism and not recognizing the contribution of their elders,
Yes.
actually do realize this is a really big, big, big political, economic, cultural issue that
Right.
needs to be talked about from the rooftops, in the same way that all the largely male activists against choice have been doing. That
Right,
it
right,
requires
right.
organization,
Yes,
public
yes.
action.
Yeah, I've been so moved by the incredible organization and really high-level strategy that has been going on across the country that I'm hearing about through all these different networks that appear to be really almost like sort of upgrading their structure and really working very hard with education. There's an organization that was formed here in the Northwest called Shout Your Abortion, which I think is doing extraordinary work. And it's just one of a powerful series of grassroots network groups that are doing amazing things. And I mean, yeah, it's funny. I know that I have the sense, and I'm happy to hear you say that because I do occasionally have the sense when I speak to my Gen Z friends that they are somewhat ahistoric. I cannot understand that. I don't know. Is that my imagination? I feel as if, I don't know, maybe that's a generational thing. Maybe every generation when they're young starts out kind of ahistoric. What is your take on that?
Well, I think it's certainly true that it is a complaint often made about middle-aged and older people, about the young. And you're barely middle-aged, but nevertheless, when I
Good.
see this happening in myself about students, because they seem uninterested, they seem unmotivated, I don't feel as though I can get through to them, I don't know what's going wrong. I bite my lip because I realize that this is a stereotype that I'm living out. They're not living out. And when you look at their work, it's often absolutely exceptional. And so I'm not saying this necessarily applies to you, but in response to your query, is this a tendency? I think it is. It's a sort of nostalgia for a lost life that actually isn't lost. It's still living in oneself and in those around one. But, in the same way that one finds genealogies of feminism often missing out on class and race.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. Wow.
So, in the present world, genealogies of feminism that do think about class and race as well as gender sometimes may forget about women in the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th centuries and all the things that they went through and sought to achieve, and how contradictory and complex those things are. For
Oh,
example,
wow.
I'll shut up in a second.
No, yeah.
In the before the Civil War here in Spain, the Republic had only, I think, one female minister in the cabinet, like secretary level in US terms. It was health minister, I think. And in common with most people on the left in those days, she was pro-eugenics,
Oh yeah. Oh,
as were
Lord.
many US feminists and British
Yeah,
feminists,
including the founder of Planned Parenthood, actually.
including the founder of Planned Parenthood. And the idea that you could breed out debility and all these things that, because of the Holocaust, are horrendous to us. So being able to put yourself back into a Marie Slopes or anybody else's mind, or Margaret Sanger, any of these people, can be as difficult and troubling as it is throwing yourself forward into the lives of young women today.
Oh, excellent point. Wow. Incredible. Yeah, well said. I appreciate that so much. And it occurs to me also that what I'm talking about, when I'm thinking about cultural visibility and sort of where we are with midlife and older women in cultural visibility, it occurs to me too that there is, in fact, at the highest sort of upper echelons of Hollywood, there is a level of visibility that is taking place. There are a lot of white female middle-aged and older actresses who have production companies. I'm thinking of the Reese Witherspoons, the Charlize Therons, the oh gosh, I mean, I'm missing so many of them, and they're creating media that in which they are, excuse me, either starring or contributing that actually is speaking to a certain level of midlife women's experience. It just happens to be a bougie white woman's level of midlife experience, but again, it's sort of, I think it. Yeah, that's a really important point, and the understanding of what the channels are to deliver that visibility and how limited they are. That's one of the reasons why I started my magazine, Woman Cake, because I love culture. I come from a family of professional symphony musicians, and I was very my background is kind of strange. I was very, very enmeshed in high culture from the perspective that classical music has always been the chosen art form, or one of the chosen art forms of the 1%. So, you know, there were these incredible in my hometown of Vancouver, Canada. You know, it was never really that status obsessed, but the people who we would define as the 1% really did keep the symphony orchestra going. And so I saw, you know, like one or two Chanel bags in my childhood, and like maybe a fur coat in the winter or something. It wasn't the way it was when I would go to the opera in New York City when I was a theater student there. But you know, there was that class difference that was there. But my parents were symphony musicians, which is a union job, and you know, not a really highly paid one. It's not like they were like, you know, in the New York Philharmonic or something. It's, you know, their salary was like, actually on paper, it was less than the garbage staff, the garbage people made, you know, the people who took out the garbage in the city, you know. But so there was this sort of high low class thing. And then for me, I was very, very obsessed with pop culture and with popular music in particular. And I had a whole music career, and I was a voice teacher, a singing teacher before I pivoted to executive coaching, which is part of how I'm able to help my clients. You know, it's like a full service, because if you have trouble with your larynx or something, I'd probably help you with that. But anyway, the point I'm making is that I was always very, very obsessed with the motion of culture and the ability of culture to reflect the transformation of society and to impact and spark the transformation of society. I think some of that for me, and you and I may have this in common. I think because I grew up outside the US media culture bubble, but adjacent to it, gave me a sort of interesting perspective, and maybe I like to think a little bit more perspective than someone who grew up kind of entrenched inside it. Maybe I'm wrong, but in any case, I turned 50, and I was asking myself, you know, what can I do to contribute to raising the voices of midlife women and older? And I just decide, I'm also like a published essayist. I published a little bit here and there. I'm not a super prolific writer yet, but I work on that. But I just created this magazine via Substack, the Substack platform, in which I feature interviews with women who are in midlife, and also some women in their 60s and 70s, and even in their 80s. And I publish their essays. Some of them are professional writers, some of them are just people doing other kinds of jobs. And I publish their first person stories and their essays about their life experiences, really just for the purposes of us being able to see each other. And I ask every guest, you know, I ask them a series of questions, and I ask every guest, do you feel comfortable sharing something about your perimenopause or your menopause experience that you feel would be helpful to a woman who's going through it? I am hoping that this question alone, and the fact that, you know, we keep amassing, you know, huge amounts of answers, I'm hoping that this will help contribute to some of the visibility about this particular experience that is missing from our culture. I want us to be able, excuse me, to speak freely about this experience in a way that encompasses, that touches all of these things that you and I are talking about, that touches the social justice aspect, that touches the sort of larger mental health aspect, and then the climate anxiety aspect, because all of those things are actually here in this issue. If we really look and see, they're all contained here. And it's so important that women are talking to each other about this. This is why we don't have the funding. We don't have the research, because there has never been enough dialogue about it. Women were supposed to shut up and get off the stage when this stuff happens to us. But it's actually the time. And here, this I can personally attest from my professional life. I can tell you anecdotally, and also from some of the survey data that I have gathered from my clients, this is the time in women's life when we achieve a degree of mastery that was heretofore unavailable to us because of the intersection of all of these things, because of what's happening in our personal lives, because of what's happening to us physiologically, because of the skills, knowledge, wisdom, and experience and expertise that we have gained. Let's say there is this enormous potential for us to come into a space of mastery, but we don't have the societal architecture. We don't have the cultural architecture. We don't have the medical architecture. We don't have the systems in place yet to support this and sustain this for women. But it's an enormous power that is just waiting there, you know, to be harnessed. I was also thinking, yeah, I wanted to say, Toby, when you were talking earlier about advertising, I wanted to say that my experience, just anecdotally, I was laughing because of some stuff my husband was saying this morning about the terrible Apple ad that came out about the iPad recently, where it like crushes all
I
of
know.
human
And I keep
culture.
thinking, they could have paid me $50 and I would have told them, don't do this.
Let them get away with that. It's like insane. But anyway, I was just thinking about how, just anecdotally, I feel like Generation X is actually very impervious to a lot of advertising BS that gets aimed at us. And that's something to do with our unique sort of generational perspective about irony or something like that. I don't know. But we do appear to be very, very resistant to advertising, a lot of traditional historic sort of advertising routes that try to reach us. That's just sort of what I've noticed. But the iPad was like a particularly egregious example. But I mean, you know, so much of the advertising that is aimed at midlife women is so cynical and jaded, and it's so pandering, and it has nothing to do really with what's actually happening to us. Or let's say it is speaking to a tiny little bit of the experience. What's actually happening to us is so vast and so varied and needs to be addressed. It needs to be talked about. So anyways, long-winded answer. That's what I'm doing
No,
with
not at
my
all.
tiny magazine, you know?
Getting back to the magazine's name,
Sure.
Woman
Oh
Cake, one
yeah.
word.
Sure. I'll explain. Yeah. So traditionally and historically, cake is employed around the world in celebrations. There are different kind of cakes and different kind of cultures and
You're
societies.
making
And
me hungry. You're making
yes,
me
I
hungry.
know. It's every time I look at my logo, I'm like, oh, that cake slice looks so good. It's our culture, our signature cultures are like ultraviolet and lavender, and that cake slice just makes my mouth water, which is why I used it in my logo. But anyway, so the idea is just, you know, the idea that when women hit midlife and older, we are viewed societally as no longer worthy of the same amount of celebration and attention as we were. So I just made a portmanteau of these two words just to remind us that this stage of our life and who we are in this time in our lives is equally worthy of celebration. That's what it is. And hopefully it's just, you know, the layers of culture and the layers of cake and all those delicious sort of things.
What do you know about your readers?
Oh, I know some things about them. Yeah. Well, we know that they are all around the world, which is pretty great. We know that they are predominantly, they identify as female. We do have some male readers, actually, and our male readership does appear to be growing, which is sort of interesting to me. And I have not done a deep dive into that. I have to get with some friends who are data scientists and talk to them about that. I know that they are predominantly college educated. They are the age range appears to be predominantly 45 through 55. They love books. They are avid readers. They love travel. They love cooking. they love what they're really reading. What they really love most in our magazine is really two things. It's the first person essays, and it's the interviews that I do with other women. And the feedback that I get, the emails that they send me and the sort of things like that all have to do with the, it's all that action of relating. So I think there is a very, I don't know, women are socially conditioned to perform, you know, so-called tend and befriend behaviors. And, you know, I think that like deep sort of relating is maybe a part of that, but so much of it is just the hunger, the desire to share their own stories and to relate. And so much of what I see in the comments and so much of the letters that they send me is, hey, you know, this experience also happened to me too, and here's how it went down. And there's that hunger to share these stories, you know, and to be, to see and to be seen and to relate and to share and to gain wisdom to, I don't know. I mean, sharing resources, for me at this stage of life, it's all of that is so crucial. To share, to connect people to resources. And I spend a lot of time reminding my clients, you know, in the professional world and in the corporate world especially, there's a huge emphasis when you're talking about career growth, there's a huge emphasis on networking, this thing called networking. But nobody really knows what that actually means. People think there's an objective definition, but there really isn't because each person, each woman's needs are different. And so I'm constantly reminding my clients to reframe their mindset away from the idea of networking to the idea of connecting, to become a connector of people, places, and resources so that you can amass a lot of goodwill within your community. And then, you know, eventually it's like a deposit in a bank. And then eventually you can make some withdrawals. So when you want to make your next career jump, you can reach out to the people that you've connected to things and say, hey, you know, can you help me or whatever. But anyway, the point I'm making is that the action of relating and of sharing is so powerful for women, and it's so important at this life, maybe more than at any other time. This is my guess.
And there are some paradoxes, if not contradictions, there, aren't there? So it is often claimed that men are not good at talking to one another, sharing their feelings, being clear about their needs. At the same time, as it's claimed they are excellent networkers
Right,
who
right.
know how to get ahead and
Right.
look after one another.
Yeah.
Women are said to be very good at sharing feelings, about sharing problems, about sharing weakness and strength, but they're also deemed to be competitive
Right.
and insufficiently connected. I mean, there are things floating around there that don't, on the surface, make sense, aren't there?
Very true. Very true. And I will add, actually, I talk about this with my fellow coaches and consultants, and I do talk about this with my very high-level, high-performing clients too. There is a thing in the corporate world called the golf problem. Have you heard about the golf problem, Toby? I can tell by your face, you know what I'm talking about, right? So for any of your listeners who don't know, the golf problem, as we're speaking about it in this context, is really the fact that in these high-level corporations and companies, there is often a faction of white, predominantly white, although I think the racial demographic sort of changes, but predominantly white men who meet on the weekends, or they take trips together to play golf. And what this means is that they are getting some work time, excuse me, off hours time to bond with other high level execs, other high level networks to create all kinds of strategies for things, to network about things, to do each other massive kinds of favors. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And many, would it shock you to learn? I don't think it will, that many times when women, my clients come into session and they talk to me, like I meet a woman for the first time in a private session and she talks to me about her awareness of the golf problem, her solution is to actually go and take golf lessons and try to learn to play the game. And like the metaphoric image here is just off the charts, right? And I'm like, look, you know, this is not going to get you where you need to go. This, it's not going to work. And it's heartbreaking. And I'm always, whenever I get to speak about my work, I'm always saying that I think my job is uniquely heartbreaking and also extremely inspiring because you can see the enormous effort, the engine behind this enormous effort that these women are doing to try and move beyond surviving and prevailing in these systems and get to thriving, which is the thing that I'm trying to always speak to my clients about, right? But so the solution, the strategy, because they're so high performing and they're so intelligent, is they're gonna, okay, I'm gonna do that too. I'm gonna get in there, I'm gonna like get the outfit, I'm gonna get some clubs, I'm gonna get a trainer, I'm gonna train for 6 months, and then I'm gonna go out on the course and hopefully I'll run into them or I'll just invite myself along. And of course, nothing happens because people don't treat them the same way. The men don't treat them the same way. It's not gonna work. So I'm waiting actually to sit on a panel. I want someone to create a panel, How Do We Solve the Golf Problem? And I want to talk about this with a lot of other high-level consultants and coaches who are working with women in these spaces. But here is my theory. I think we need to look at what the golf situation is actually solving, what it's actually doing for these men. And we need to recognize that women need to create our own networks, high level, high performing networks that are doing the same things for us. I think it's really simple. I don't think integrating into the world of golf is going to do it for us. I think we need to create our own architecture, our own networks, our own systems. And I can report with great hope, I think, based on my work, that there are women in these systems who are attempting to do this. I believe that there are high-level, high-performing women who are aware of this issue and they are working on this. I don't think we have nearly enough of these women, and that's because they're not really supported. They're not getting any real, there isn't really, again, the architecture's not in place there. But I do believe it is starting to happen. I think it is happening. And every time I get to encounter those women, I feel so inspired, and I feel like there is hope for us individually and collectively.
Now, without giving away trade secrets, which is a
Sure.
slightly unfortunate beginning to a question, could you tell us something about what happens such that a corporation or a smaller firm or an individual contacts you? Is there a switching point? Is there a crisis moment? Is there some body in
Oh.
human resources or personnel, as I
Oh,
still like it to be known, who contacts you because there's a gender issue at the workplace?
that's a really good question. It's funny. I've been doing my job for a really long time. I'm going to pull back from the micro for a second and just talk about the macro. I've been doing my job for a really long time. I don't spend a lot of time, so-called advertise. I don't spend any advertising dollars on social media. I don't spend a lot of time on social media. I'm very much on LinkedIn and through my own personal, newsletter, my monthly newsletter, which you can find on my website, by the way. So all to say that I've been doing my job for a really long time. Predominantly clients come to me through referrals, and I'm very, very fortunate because I have wonderful clients who really believe in my work. In answer to your question, I would say that typically what happens is there is the women inside a company or corporation reach a critical mass among themselves where they start to recognize that they are not getting the support that they need to jump up, to jump forward in those systems. And here I want to say, please, I want to make an entreaty to these global corporations and companies who are attempting to buy women's loyalty by giving them meaningless perks. Like, I don't know, manicure and pedicures in the office, or wine trips, field trips on a Friday afternoon to a winery. Stop doing these things and start investing in the women in your company by giving them robust professional development. It is what they want. It is what they need. And you don't have to take my word for this. You can survey the women in your company. You can ask them what it is that they want. And spoiler alert, they're going to tell you the same. Well, okay, there's going to be variation, but they're going to tell you predominantly three things. They want more paid vacation time. They want robust professional development, and they want a serious, dedicated investment in their future inside those companies. They want this. Oh, and also they want some more flexible work hours, which in fact the pandemic did to a certain extent kind of take care of. So the women decide we want this. And here I should say also, by the way, that I work with multi-gender groups. So I have relationships with corporations where I'm teaching mixed gender cohorts, and that's wonderful too. But my real passion is working with groups of women. So the women decide that they want this. Ideally, there is within the corporation itself, there is an ERG, an employee resource group for the women. So, the women of this company, the women of that company, and then there's some, subgroups. There's like, Black women of this company or South Asian women of this company or whatever. So, and there's ideally, by the way, companies and corporations, please, I hope you're listening. Ideally, there's a line item in the budget for these groups where they can receive robust professional development. And also, by the way, ideally that budget keeps increasing. Please don't do what this corporation did when they brought me their report that I was looking at last month in my capacity as a consultant for gender equity in the workplace. Please don't do what this corporation did, which is that they created a women's ERG, a line item for the budget in 2010, and then they never increased the budget. Okay. Please keep up with the budget. All right. And then what you have is somebody reaches out to me and they say, hey, can you send us some information about your trainings or whatever? And then I typically jump on a Zoom with them and I learn more about them. And then I create a package for them, which is based on a series of skills. There's different levels that I teach. And then I go there, either I'm with them on site in the room, which is my great pleasure. I love to do that, or I'll be with them in a Zoom. And we create this partnership. So I teach them level one, and then I give them some instructions about practicing and coaching each other and how they can keep doing that. So they go off and they work on those skills. And then they come back to me and they say, okay, we're ready for level two. So then we do that and we get to level three. And at that point, it's really, really high level performance. That's where I'm like flying out to, you know, somebody who's about to speak to the board of some company or corporation or something, and I'm backstage with them, coaching them, and we're working on some strategy and stuff like that. But there's a series of skills that we really work on to get there. And I'll tell you what, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. It's pretty serious, you know, up
And
there. So,
on
yeah.
that very topic, speech, confidence, skills, preparedness for women executives. What are some of the issues that you typically encounter that women are experiencing that might be different from men when it comes to speaking?
Oh, well, I mean, we'll be here all day if I get into it, but I can tell you, so generally speaking, across genders, there does seem to be plenty of data to indicate that if you want to be taken seriously as an expert, any expert, any sector, you need to be able to demonstrate equal parts warmth and competence. Competence, not confidence, actually, but competence. That's not to say that confidence is not important, but warmth and competence are the things that really do seem to make the most impact. And there are four things that we expect from any expert in any industry in any sector. They are robust, excuse me, they are informed opinions, robust persuasion, really powerful constructive criticism, and future predictions. You need to be able to do all four of these things to be take for your expertise to be taken seriously and to be viewed as an expert. But you and I know that there is an enormous amount of gender conditioning around the ways that we communicate. And this is true professionally, it's true personally. And so quite often, what happens when I my clients come into session and I see this, you know, broadly applied across the population of women, although there are certain variations, is that women inside these systems have adopted what I call the BTS mindset, which stands for behind the scenes. So either they have been in behind the scenes roles inside these companies in these systems, or they have used, enacted a behind the scenes mindset again to help them survive and prevail within the systems. So that has a way of manifesting in terms of their professional communication and in terms of the way that they show up in the systems. So they will have a tendency to qualify and minimize their points. They will have a tendency to think out loud and express themselves in a way that is very, that sort of softens the point or softens the impact of what they're saying. They will certainly provide all kinds of apologies that are unnecessary. They, and you know, here I want to say that, you know, on the other side, they're used to being, you know, discounted and certainly interrupted. Toby, have you seen the extraordinary, have you seen the extraordinary New York Times article called, it is the, oh gosh, I'm having a mind blank moment. It is about, oh, it's called the Universal Phenomenon of Men Interrupting Women. Have you seen this article? Perhaps we can include it in the show notes if you do things like that. I always show up in every single training that I give with a list of resources. It's a sheet, it's an email that goes out to everybody after the training. And this article is always inside that email because it's so important that we face reality, right? If we want to really change the systems and change the way they work from the inside, we have to look at what's really happening. So quick spoiler alert for anybody listening. It turns out data has been gathered from all over the world. This phenomenon of men interrupting women is so common that we as a society, as a culture, no longer notice it anymore. Like, can we just let that sink in? You know, and there's so much we can extrapolate from this, right? And like the repercussions of how this plays out in women's daily lives and certainly in women's professional lives. So some of what I'm doing certainly is helping women recognize what's actually happening to them, recognize the effects of this kind of behavior in the workplace, and getting them to work to get work individually, certainly on their own behalf, but to work collectively to push back on these things through very powerful actions that can actually help. My favorite expression is women together can change the weather. And I can tell you that the weather inside these systems is not so good for women. So we really need to be working together over and over. My message is simple. Please, let's work together. It's so much more effective if we come together and learn these skills and practice with each other, coach each other. I'm telling them, you know, all these, there's a thing I teach called the four pillars of public speaking. You all know what those are. Coach each other, listen to each other's presentations, listen for the four pillars, right? Listen for the four elements of expertise that I mentioned earlier. And then we'll come together again and we'll go to the next level. We'll jump there. But that group, that sort of, you know, that wonderful, it's the thing we all miss during the pandemic, that wonderful collective energy field that is formed when women come together. I just don't know any better way to do it. I certainly teach mixed gender cohorts, and here I will say that I do the mixed gender cohorts with the companies who have shown through actions as well as words that they really are more progressive and they really do value gender equity in a real way, in a genuine way. And I love to work within those systems and work with those clients because it's great. But I don't know any better way for women to get in touch with our power and amass our power and direct our power than through really coming together in gender-based solidarity. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this has been true throughout history. I think this is why this action is so threatening to patriarchy. Am I missing something? Tell me if I'm wrong.
I don't think you are. We've got 5 minutes until I guarantee to
Yes.
liberate you, as it were.
Thank
You
you.
liberate
Yes.
yourself for your next meeting. I wondered if I could ask you one more question.
Yes, please.
And if you could then, in answering, add anything you would wish to what we've already said
Sure.
or anything we haven't touched on.
Yes.
So I want to ask you about the M word, which is in this case music, which you mentioned in terms of mom and dad. You have a
Yes.
guitar sitting behind you,
Was
which
my 50th
is
birthday present from my husband. It's so wonderful. It's just a little hollow body Squier
with
Telecaster.
an
It's beautiful.
amplifier.
Yes.
And you are on your website, a regular performer.
Yes.
You're in a duo. You've brought out lots of records. Can
Yes.
you tell us a bit about your musical career? Because
Oh,
one of the things
gosh.
you explain on the website is that this is actually important in voice terms.
Yes. Okay. So I am a trained singer. Yeah. I mean, I started out, like I said before, I have a background in classical music. My father has a master's degree from Juilliard, so I'm really standing on the shoulders of giants, but I chose not to pursue a career in classical music. It was not right for me. And I think that there is a, you know, you're talking about musicians and singers in that arena are basically scholars of the art form. You know, Toby, my joke about my parents and about that whole kind of world is that they're kind of living in the 70s, like the 1770s. And my whole thing was really very much more about like sort of living in the modern world. And I was so much more obsessed with what was happening sort of in the here and now. But the training that I received as a singer, I still maintain is the single most valuable for me personally, the single most valuable element to my success, because I learned, much as we've been discussing here, and as is the case with how my career has played out, first of all, I learned a whole bunch of really powerful skills for maintaining a powerful voice and for maintaining the health of your voice, taking care of it, and projecting your voice in spaces where you have to be performative, such as in corporate America, and show up with a very strong, let's say, personal brand, for lack of a better word. But I also recognized the power of harmony. And so much of my training was about singing in harmony with other people, with other children and other teens. And the concept of what harmony singing is, I don't think we have enough neuroscience yet about this, but I can just tell you, and I think anyone who's ever done it knows this, You can come into a choir practice with any kind of massive burden on your shoulders. And by the time you are done with that practice, it feels light as a feather. And this is not an accident. It's not your imagination. It is, I believe, something to do with the neuroscience of the literal and figurative harmonizing with the brain, the sort of like co-regulation of the nervous system and of the brain and all of these things that we're now just sort of beginning to learn about. It happens within the choir. And then the beautiful sound of it and the sort of directed energy, the power of all those things, and the fact that it has existed in the human population since the very beginning of time. All of these things are, I believe that they, for me, they compose a kind of deep awareness and understanding of attunement, the quality of attunement with another human being. And if I have a strength as a coach, I believe that is really at the core of it. It is my respect for and my ability to attune to other human beings, which I learned directly from my musical background. You're nothing as a performer if you can't go in and read the room. It doesn't matter how much you've practiced your performance. You can't go out there like a robot. You have to be open and porous. It's a, this is why I'm unafraid to perform, because I learned as a child, it is not us, the performer, versus them, the audience. It's not us versus them. It is us together having this collective experience through which we will be transformed and uplifted. This is my mandate as a coach. It is my mandate as a performer. And I think, I don't want to be like too prescriptive, but I think maybe it could be our mandate as human beings. If we can please save the planet. That's what I got.
Anything you'd like to add to what we've said?
Oh gosh, I just, if there are any midlife women listening, I would love for you to send me a draft. Please go to my website. It's womancake.com. Have a look at our magazine, and just we just need your story. We need you to talk more. We need you to listen. We need you to be in dialogue in this time in our lives. It is so important. We need state-of-the-art healthcare. We need political power. We need cultural visibility. I love you. I need you. And also same to you, Toby. I love you and I need you too. And thank you.
Thank you. It was great chatting.